The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, Union College in Schenectady, New York, has selected its next president. Elizabeth Kiesch will become the private institution's first female president in its 230-year history. And new research reveals new details about the nervous system of octopuses. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Union College in Schenectady has named its new president, the first female in the role in the campus's 230-year history. Elizabeth Kiesch will become Union's 20th president on July 1st. She succeeds David Harris, who is stepping down after 7 years. The 63-year-old Kiesch is a New York City native and former Rhodes Scholar who spent 12 years as president of Agnes Scott College in Atlanta. The philosopher has led the Rhodes Trust for the past 7 years. I spoke with Dr. Kiesch to learn more about her background and goals for the private liberal arts college.
So I am a New Yorker by birth, so daughter of Hungarian refugees. I grew up in the Bronx and went to PS 56. So coming to Union is coming back to New York, which is great. And I then went to college in North Carolina, to Davidson College, another wonderful liberal arts college. And I was fortunate enough to be selected as a Rhodes Scholar from Davidson. So I did my graduate work in Oxford, which is also where I met my husband, Jeff Holzgrief, who is an Aussie. So we met in Oxford. And my career has been, so I taught at Princeton, taught at a couple of other places as well. And then for 10 years was the founding director of an ethics institute at Duke, the Kenan Institute for Ethics, which coincidentally is celebrating its 30th anniversary this week. So that's kind of fun. It's a great week. Then I was president of Agnes Scott College in Decatur, Georgia, just outside of Atlanta for 12 years. And then 7 years ago came back to Oxford to lead the Rhodes Trust. So I'm a philosopher by training, and now I'm going to be starting at Union College.
So why Schenectady? Why Union? What attracted you to this job?
Yeah, so, you know, I was really keen to come back to the U.S., and I just love liberal arts colleges. I think they're uniquely American institutions, and they do. I mean, I'm the product of one. I just love how they create this platform for young people, and a really wonderful campus culture and community. And then I fell absolutely in love with Union from the very beginning of the search process. And I guess it has to do with a lot of things. It has to do with, you know, it is such a innovative school. I mean, from the get-go, like, it was one of the very first schools in America to teach modern languages and natural sciences, and then started an engineering school. So it, you know, as I think about what a liberal arts education should look like in the 21st century, that span from the humanities and arts to engineering and computer science is really exciting to me. It's a beautiful campus. I love the fact that a third of the students are varsity athletes. So it's, you know, it's got a really good vibe and energy. And then both Jeff and I just loved Schenectady, you know, found it. It's, you know, it's a city with a very proud history, but it was just so cool to see everything that's going on there, the kind of the new restaurants and the new, you know, shops and everything. So it also gave us a sense of returning to New York, but also being a part of a community that's on the move.
So private liberal arts colleges in particular are facing financial challenges. Union is not too far from where I'm speaking to you from, Albany, where the College of St. Rose closed last year. But Union also completed a very significant capital campaign just a couple of years ago and has been strong in its fundraising. But what are you particularly concerned about when it comes to the educational landscape and the fiscal challenges that private liberal arts colleges like Union College may be experiencing?
Yes, so it is. It's a challenging time for small liberal arts colleges, for sure. As you say, union is the envy of a lot of colleges. I mean, it's got a really strong endowment, has done extremely well under President David Harris's leadership in its fundraising, and a really energized alumni community. It comes down to, I think, and this is what I'm very excited to work with faculty and staff and trustees on, is how do we take the kind of secret sauce that is a union education and elevate it, make it more bold, more visible, because it is a case of like communicating that value proposition to students and prospective applicants and their families. And I was involved in that kind of work at Agnes Scott, another liberal arts college, a women's liberal arts college. And so I know, how energizing it can be to work across a campus community to think, okay, we've got so many great things going on. How do we make them more visible to our marketplace, to prospective students?
What are some of the other roles that you find particularly important for a college president beyond the fundraising and beyond the marketing aspects, if you will, of higher ed? What do you think it takes to be a well-seen and a well-appreciated college president by the students and the staff?
Sure. Well, it's actually part of what I love about the role is that you do get to engage with students, with faculty, with staff. Before the public announcement today, I had the chance to meet with the Faculty Executive Council, with the Staff Council, with the student government, and also with the senior leadership team. And it's all those people, and of course, people all across campus. It's important to be visible, to learn from people, to be a community builder, and I look forward to that. I enjoy that work, but also with alumni and parents. That's the beauty of a campus community, is that there are so many stakeholders, and you can laugh that like every one of those stakeholders thinks they're the most important, but they're all really important. Engaging all of those stakeholders is very important, and I find it quite energizing. And then the other piece, which I've already spoken to President David Harris about, is getting involved in Schenectady, because I do think that, especially under his leadership, the partnership between Union College and the city of Schenectady has been really mutually beneficial and valuable. I mean, I'm excited about the new ice hockey rink, arena. And also just excited to explore other ways in which the college can be a good citizen and a partner in Schenectady and in the region. And then I guess the last thing is, I do think this is a time when higher education leaders need to articulate the value of academic freedom, of freedom of speech, of building an inclusive community, of bringing young people together. I love the vision statement for Union College of developing every student to lead with wisdom, empathy, and courage. Those are really important values for the present moment. And so I hope that I will also have opportunities in collaboration with other people across higher ed to stand up for and champion those values.
How do you feel about some of the most recent executive actions from President Trump with regards to DEI and withholding federal funding, and/or his pause, his freeze on federal grants and loans, including research funding? What do you think, and how will you approach these challenges?
Sure. So, I think it is one of the great assets of the United States that it has a higher education system that is the envy of the world. Students around the world want to come to the United States to study. And that's because it has created, Americans have had the freedom to create these vibrant college and university communities. that are inclusive, that bring students from all backgrounds together to learn from each other, to become, you know, citizens in community with each other. So I feel really strongly about those values of inclusion. And I also feel very strongly about the value of research and the importance of research funding for the future, not only of colleges and universities. This is about the future of American competitiveness. You know, this is about how we will continue as a country to excel in a very competitive global society and economy. So, you know, I'm not starting till July, so I still have a lot to learn about Union, but I really hope that I will have a chance, you know, as I say, in collaboration with others to champion the value of support for research and of support for building inclusive learning communities that, you know, prepare young people for citizenship in the United States and beyond.
With the changes in Washington, though, does being a college president require a kind of new flexibility, if you will? Is there a need to sort of anticipate something that may not be able to be anticipated?
Right. Well, the world always throws you curveballs, right? So, you know, I was a college president at Agnes Scott when the recession happened, the 08 recession, which, you know, certainly hugely impacted every college and university and, of course, every business and every organization. And I was warden of Rhodes House when COVID hit. So I think it comes with the territory that you do have to respond to the challenges of what's happening in the world. But I think, you know, across all three of those, I would say it's really important to be clear about your fundamental values. You know, what is your mission? What are the fundamental values of what is the fundamental value of higher education? And to work, you know, with your trustees, with your faculty and staff and alumni to stand up for those. So, you know, it's never boring. And there's always unexpected challenges. But I think it's precisely in a challenging time that it's most important to try to instantiate and to stand up for your core values.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it. Anything else that you're looking forward to as you prepare for your arrival in Schenectady?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to getting to know the region as well. I mean, Jeff and I have traveled around the Adirondacks and the Berkshires. It's such a beautiful part of the world. So very much looking forward to that. And I'm an avid hiker, so I'm hoping to be able to tackle some of the 46ers in the Adirondacks. So that's something that I'm looking forward to. And also going to the Proctor Theater, which I haven't yet been inside, but when I was there for final interview, we stayed at the hotel right next door, the Hampton Inn, and it just looks incredible. And so I'm looking forward to catching some shows too.
Elizabeth Kiesch has been named Union College's next president. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Octopus arms move with impressive ability. The curlable, bendable tentacles are the defining characteristic of the animal. New research shows that the nervous systems in octopuses' arms are segmented, giving the animal precise control over their 8 appendages. Cassidy Olson, a PhD candidate in the Committee of Computational Neuroscience at the University of Chicago, is a co-author of the study published in Nature Communications. The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with her to find out more.
The way that we think about it is that the octopus has basically the equivalent of a spinal cord down every single arm. And this spinal cord structure is what we found to be segmented. This segmentation you can think of as repeated local processing units. so that subdivide the arm. So instead of just one central command from the brain controlling the entire arm, there's these repeated processing units that have local motor processing for parts of the arm. And we think, just given the complexity of how flexible these arms are, the fact that there are these local processing units make it easier to control, instead of just having the brain have to come up with a control signal for the entire arm at once.
And what do octopuses do with their arms? I know this is a simple question, but I'm curious. So what are their functions, and kind of describe what these arms and tentacles look like for the listeners and I.
So they can do a lot with their arms. Most importantly, they capture prey. So they're very ravenous hunters and eaters. So in the lab, we feed them crabs every day, and they'll use their arms to pounce on the crabs and grab them. And then they will also dig in gravel with their arms. They'll build shelters. We give them a bunch of like cells and things like that that they will take to build shelters for themselves using their arms. They'll groom themselves. They have this really interesting grooming behavior where they'll like flip their arms up over their mantle and like rub them against the mantle to like groom themselves, which is really weird and cool to see. No, they're very curious animals too. So their suckers on their arms are like lined with chemotactile receptors. So this is basically, think of like you have a tongue or a nose on every single sucker. So they'll reach out with a single arm to like explore an area to try to get a sense of like, okay, what's in this area using their suckers.
I'm glad you mentioned these suckers because I actually have a question about them. So, does this segmented nervous system affect the suckers in any way? And, what are the suckers' functions for this octopus?
So we found that the segmentation creates a spatial map for the suckers. And what this means is that each individual sucker is also subdivided into smaller processing units. And for example, segment A will send and receive information to one part of the sucker. We can call it part A. And segment B, which is right next to segment A, will send and receive signals to part B of the sucker, which is right next to part A, and so on and so forth until the whole sucker is tiled. So this creates a nice map of the sucker. So spatially, you have information from all parts of the sucker. And the suckers are also very wild appendages. Just like the arms themselves, each individual sucker can be moved independently. And for our species, there's about 150 suckers down the length of a single arm. So that's just a crazy, crazy problem of like how do you control each of these individual suckers, but they do it. And we think having the spatial map allows them to maybe target a single sucker and a single part of a single sucker. In addition to moving independently, they can also move coordinatedly across the different suckers and across suckers of different arms. So prey capture, like their hunting behavior, requires them to grab with multiple arms and multiple suckers. So you have this massive coordination. So it is a big problem, and I think we've only uncovered a small piece of that problem, but hopefully, that'll move our understanding forward.
And I just kind of want to know, what does the entire nervous system of this species of octopus look like? And like, how does that function? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of different nervous systems in this one octopus. So I'm just curious about that.
And sometimes when studying them, it feels like everything is just nervous system. But they do have a central brain, and you can think of this kind of like for motor control, the central brain is incorporating sensory feedback like vision. So including they're very visual creatures, so including vision in their motor behaviors, coordinating movement across arms. You can think of the central brain as having control over, movements of the entire animal. Then, like I said, we think of the analogy is that central brain, and then they have eight spinal cords. So the axial nerve cord that's segmented, which we studied, is hooked up to the central brain, kind of like a spinal cord in us is hooked up to our brain.
And in your research to test this segmented nervous system, you compared it with a squid that I believe is somewhat similar to this species of octopus. Of course, it's a squid, so it's an entirely different animal. But I'm wondering, what did you find and what results did you have?
Yeah, so we compared it to the squid Doritoothis palei. This squid is affectionately known as the MBL squid or the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. That's where we got our samples from. And squid, unlike octopus, squid have 8 arms, just like octopus do, but they also have 2 tentacles. And the way we think about tentacles is that they are distinct from arms. So an arm will have suckers all the way down the length of it. Whereas a tentacle has 2 components. So they have a stalk that does not have suckers, and then they have a club that has suckers. So this provided a convenient example to test like this hypothesis of, are suckers important for segmentation? And yeah, we found that's true because the squid arm does have segments because it has suckers, it has segments. The segmentation that we see is a little less complex than what we see in the octopus. And we think this is because of just the general behaviors of the squid versus the octopus, because the octopus is on the ocean floor and interacting with a lot of a diverse landscape, whereas the squid tend to be out in the open ocean. When we looked at the tentacle, we found that the tentacle stalk, which does not have suckers, does not have segments. So that really like shows this link between segmentation and suckers. And then the club of the tentacle, which does have suckers, had segments again. So again, there's this very strong link between segmentation and suckers.
Just how do these octopuses move with this specific segmented nervous system that they have, and how are their movements impacted by it?
So if you imagine the behavior of like an octopus reaching its arm out, so their arms are typically curled and then they'll unfurl them to reach them out. So what that would look like is potentially is that each individual segment, as you go down the arm, as the arm is unfurling, is activated. And then it's sending signals to segments before it and after it to let them know, okay, hey, I'm activated. And it just smoothly unfurls the arm with all these segments being sequentially activated. And that's a simple behavior, but you can think of that as like it for more complex behaviors. Maybe it's only the distal part, segments in the distal part of the arm are activated to control movements there. If it were to bend or curl there, you have a single segment that's activated, and then that signal propagates to and from that single segment, allowing it to move around.
And you also kind of mentioned this in your answer, saying that you believe from your research that there are other octopuses that do have this segmented nervous system because of the relation of suckers to this segmented nervous system and in other animals. So like, do you believe that is true? And if so, why? And like, you know, how many? Is it just like all across the board sort of thing?
Yeah. So a lot of the initial research into the octopus nervous system was done on Octopus vulgaris. And this is the common octopus that's found in the Mediterranean Sea, for instance, and it's a much larger animal. But research dating back to the 1960s, looking at the nervous system of these animals, and in those images of the stainings that they did, we were able to go back and see, oh, well, that looks like it's segmented, equivalent to how our animal is segmented. So it's kind of like once you realize the pattern, you start seeing it everywhere. But I think it'd be a really interesting comparative study to look across species of octopuses, because there are some that only have a single row of suckers. So our animal has 2 rows. So how does the segmentation pattern change? Or is there still a segmentation pattern if there's only 1 row of suckers? And the suckers can vary in shape and size across different species of octopuses and also squid, and like the types of suckers. So that it's a very interesting comparative question. Yeah, how does this vary across like cephalopods generally?
And could you just kind of describe some of these specific type of suckers for us as listeners? I know it might be difficult, but I am genuinely curious. Like, I know how they look. They kind of look like suction cups a little bit.
Yeah.
But I'm just curious what those characteristics are for this octopus and maybe others that you know of.
Yeah, so for our octopus, might be getting a little bit in the weeds about structure of muscle, but like there's all these muscles that come from around the arm and wrap down to anchor the sucker in place, which allows it to hopefully move around a little bit more. Whereas with the squid that we studied, it seemed like there's a more concentrated stalk in the center of muscles that come down, and then the cup shape is different. It's more like a compressed tulip is all I'm coming up with. Whereas like the octopus one is maybe more of like an elongated tulip. Also suckers that in some species of squid that have barbs in them. So they actually have like little hooks. And then so starfish, for example, have these little tube feet. Like that's how they crawl around. And I think this type of squid has on the end of their tentacle clubs has like a tube feet like structure on the end instead of like suckers.
And my last question to you is, what are you excited for with this research for the future? Are you going to look into it more? And what are you excited to do next?
So my study focused a lot on the description of the structure, and it'd be really interesting to look into the function. So we've generated a lot of functional predictions of how the segmentation could work and could control the arm, and be really cool to stick an electrode in the arm and see, does it function the way that we think it'll function? I think that to me is one of the most exciting next steps for the octopus. But yeah, and I think there's also a lot of interesting questions about levels of control, like we kind of got into, where they have the central brain that does all this stuff, and then you have this arm that does all this stuff. Like how do those things relate to one another? Like how does, because obviously they're all interacting, and the octopus is clearly being very effective in all its movements and things like that. So that's also another like really exciting thing to think about.
Cassidy Olson is a PhD candidate in the Committee of Computational Neuroscience at the University of Chicago. Her research on octopus arms is published in Nature Communications. She spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1795. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.